Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it take to really go green? Journalist Doug Fine decided to try it when he purchased a 41-acre ranch near Silver City, New Mexico, a few years ago. He was all set to grow his own food, install his own solar panels, even trade in his trusty 200,000-mile Subaru for a farm truck that ran on recycled restaurant grease. Big stuff for a guy raised in Long Island, New York, on Domino's Pizza, who admits he is genetically unhandy. The result has been a journey that, while far from smooth, has been endlessly interesting and instructive. And Fine, whose voice you will recognize as a regular contributor to NPR, has written it all down in his new book, Farewell, My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. Doug, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Chris.
You make the point that you are still living like an American throughout all this. What does that mean to you?
Well, there's been books written about people who are serious about getting petroleum out of their life, and they seem to have to emulate a lifestyle that would not be feasible for sort of the busy, regular, average person. And so I wanted to see, could I do this in a way where I could keep my Netflix and my fridge and most of all my booming stereo subwoofers?
And so you decided the way to do that was to go solar.
Yeah. I mean, one of the three main things was to not have to pay an electric bill anymore, because most of our grid electric companies these days are powered by coal or natural gas or nuclear or some combination of those. So solar panels was one way to go. And I'm laughing because you mentioned in the intro the sort of lack of genetic predisposition to the kind of skills necessary for, say, wiring things without electrocuting myself.
Multiple times you zapped yourself, right?
Yeah. At one point I could smell myself burning internally afterwards. So much of Farewell, My Subaru is about me doing these things wrong, but hopefully so the reader can laugh at me and say, hey, if this guy can do it, I can do it.
Yeah, well, the solar, though, one thing that's really interesting, you said you're not paying an electric bill, you're not supporting coal-fired energy or natural gas or anything, but this set you back, what, 35 years worth of electric bills?
Yeah, I joke at one point in the book that, you know, the payback time of 72 years can go down to 71 with tax rebates. Actually, it does pay back quicker than that. On the average home, depending on things like what Congress does with tax rebates, you're looking at 6 to 12 years in financial payback, but there's a more immediate payback in that you're immediately no longer contributing to things like offshore drilling in Alaska or violence in Nigeria or the Middle East.
Did you look into, and I guess your plan is to stick there for a while, but did you look into to resale? If you sell the ranch, will someone be willing to pay the amount of money that you laid out for these panels?
That's a really good question. I haven't really looked into that too much. I'm hoping that one of the offshoots of the fact that green living and sustainable living seems to be outgrowing fad status and is moving into the mainstream is that these type of things will be benefits for home resale, especially for those who want to be independent of any potential oil price hikes or problems with the globalization.
Yeah, it seems to come up over and over that if more people would just start doing this, not only would the price come down, but it wouldn't seem so strange. What does it take to get a larger number of people interested enough in these technologies to cause them to be more affordable to everyone?
Well, I hope interviews like this and books like Farewell, My Subaru, but in fact, already I see it in things like friends from back east who will, I think I talk about in the book, as people are starting to change from thinking that this experiment is radically subversive to just radically unfeasible. Now we just need to get them into the next phase of thinking that it's not so unfeasible. And we, as consumers, make the decisions with our pocketbooks. Solar power is actually a great investment. The panels are often warranted for 30 years. I mean, you are in good shape if you buy a system.
You do talk about the panels are warranted for 30 years, but the batteries are good for 5 or 10, and you definitely have found yours to be somewhat unwieldy.
I would say, well, the system itself is not unwieldy. One of the things I am most pleasantly surprised about with the book is, with the experiments in the book, is how seamless it is. I don't even notice I'm on solar power. In fact, I will notice that the rest of the valley will be blacked out in some sort of grid problem, and I will have my fridge and washing machine and stereo going because of solar. But you are absolutely right, Chris, that I think the biggest environmental hole in not just my solar setup but in things like electric cars is battery technology. And when I speak to schools, especially, you know, universities and there's engineering students, I say, you know, major in battery engineering. We need to figure something, you know, a little more advanced than Edison was working on so that we're not disposing of lead and acid every 10 years.
And is it true that solar works better on cool days than hot ones?
Yeah, that was a big surprise. Essentially, what is powering your solar panels, and this is different than the solar water setup that I have, but what's powering solar electricity is the light from the sun, not the heat from the sun. And it's actually most efficient at sort of a lukewarm temperature. It's not great below freezing. It's not great at, you know, 100 degrees. Or it's less efficient. So you actually want cool sunny temperatures.
But you and people think, well, outside Silver City, you've got sun all the time. But you actually have an abundance of sunshine. You wouldn't need that much to make the system work well.
In fact, what you have to be careful about in southern latitudes is overcharging your batteries and overstimulating your system. Let me tell you, from some of the electric shocks I've received before I learned a crucial lesson of work with a professional, that's definitely true. But even northern latitudes, I was speaking in Alaska recently, northern latitudes, solar is still good for maybe 8-plus months of the year, and then if you really want to fully be renewable, sustainable, and off the grid, you have to think about combining it with something like wind, hydro, or geothermal.
What made you decide, Doug, to do this, as much of this yourself as you possibly could? Leading to dangerous incidents daily.
I'll tell you, Chris, I think that I'm making a career of doing things badly. I find that people relate to a narrator who doesn't take himself too seriously and isn't an expert. How many of us haven't been annoyed at opening this sort of self-help book, how-to home improvement book, and, you're seeing this described in pictures, making it look like it's a piece of cake, but no mention of that valve that has 17 pieces, you know, or something like that. So I have sort of made a career of messing up and screwing up in my couple of books now, and Farewell My Subaru is no exception. I think to do it yourself is a way not just to learn but to make mistakes and describe it to people so that they won't make the same mistakes. And every part of the book, solar heating, driving on vegetable oil, and raising local food, that's been the case.
One thing that I thought was fascinating about the book and that you covered really well was the idea that a lot of the technologies any of us would use to go green have trade-offs, not just financially, but even environmentally. We talked a little bit about the battery issue, but even your water pipes were an issue.
Yeah, I give a lot of thought to that. Plastic water pipes require this awful, icky purple primer and this toxic cement to bind together. The fellow I was working on with this part of it said, oh, don't worry about it. Once it dries, you know, it's approved for potable use, and this cement we were using. And then he said, but just don't let it get on your hands because it wrecks your liver. So, yeah, there's those issues to deal with. But that raises kind of two points for me. And one is, first of all, nobody's perfect. I'm not trying to make anybody feel guilty in this book for their lifestyles. I'm just saying if you're a busy American with a job and you're thinking about the planet and the future and climate change and healthy planet for the children and all that good stuff, you can take these steps one at a time, and you don't have to feel like a bad person if you go solar but don't convert your vehicle right away. You can do one thing at a time. The other thing is, with a lot of bad press coming out about some types of renewable energy, for instance, corn-based ethanol, I think deservedly is getting some bad press, that doesn't mean all biofuels are bad. So we shouldn't shrug off good intentions and good behavior just because we're making our decisions before there's a market. Yet we create the market for this stuff.
You've got a neighbor who's trying to grow algae?
That's right, yeah. I think algae is really a promising biofuel in the future. It can sometimes live on toxic waste or other kinds of waste, doesn't require an awful lot of farmland, and can produce oils that might be able to be biofuels.
So let's talk about trading in the Subaru, which is where the title comes from, Farewell My Subaru. You went with a giant truck that is, in fact, one step beyond biodiesel, which a lot of people have heard of. This runs literally on food grease.
Right, straight vegetable oil, some people call it, or SVO. So, yeah, first of all, I had to get rid of the Subaru because I've driven 12,000 gallons of unleaded, I calculated, and it's 200-something thousand miles. And I wanted to get that out of my life, and I wanted to see if I could do it, you know, tomorrow. And it turns out from my research, you can. There's future technologies that might be better in the long term, be it solar, be it better electric cars with more efficient and cleaner batteries, be it hydrogen or algae-based or switchgrass-based fuels. And these are all on the horizon, and I think we should encourage our legislators to switch from supporting oil subsidies to research into these kind of things. But for now, what if you want to stop going to the pump tomorrow? you have to get a diesel engine. So when I said farewell to my Subaru, I needed a four-wheel drive vehicle because the last mile of the highway to my funky Butte Ranch in the remote part of New Mexico is maintained with the frequency of the highway system, let's say in Somalia.
Which is to say never.
Which is to say never. So I needed to get a four-wheel drive vehicle, and we just don't have a lot of options in the U.S. if you need diesel and four-wheel drive. So I had to go with the Ford truck that I call the ROAT, the ridiculously oversized American truck, which, was a V8, which is twice as many Vs as I was used to driving on, whatever that means.
It's like the anti-NPR vehicle.
Right. I went from, like, the Subaru Progressive. I think the only station my new truck gets is NASCAR races, no matter what button you press on the preset.
So where do you go to get the stuff?
So you have a couple options where I live. One is you can dumpster dive. I've got the concession at the Kentucky Fried Chicken. I find myself rooting for unhealthy dietary trends in American appetites so that there's more waste grease fryers to raid. But I also happen to have somebody, luckily in my part of New Mexico, who does this for a living. He picks up the stuff from restaurants and does the greasy, disgusting filtering of it all. And he sells it to me for $1.50 a gallon, which just I save in $4 a gallon is diesel, just in cleaning costs, laundry costs alone from my greasy overalls, I'm paying this thing off right away and supporting a local business. And just to get into that clarification between biodiesel and straight vegetable oil, what happens with biodiesel is people take the waste vegetable oil and they process it in such a way that it can go into a regular diesel engine. But there's some questions about the byproducts that come, glycerin and other things, from making biodiesel. What I'm doing on straight vegetable oil is I had to undergo a modification of the diesel engine, which cost a couple $1,000s, and then your vegetable oil can go right from the waste fire trap, as long as you filter it, right into your special new tank. And believe me, you pay off that couple $1,000s within 6 months in saved fuel costs.
And does it go sort of gallon for gallon, the kind of efficiency you'd get from diesel in a regular truck?
It's more efficient. Rudolf Diesel, the inventor of the diesel engine, explicitly intended for farmers to grow and produce their own fuel so that they would be independent. He thought peanut oil was a good way to go in Europe. And so the engine loves it. It's quieter. It's slightly more fuel efficient. It all around likes the vegetable oil better than diesel.
And you joke that driving around, everything smells like Kung Pao chicken.
I have to say, that's the one piece of advice. If you're going to convert your diesel engine to straight vegetable oil, don't drive hungry or you're going to be pulling over at every stop, mysteriously drawn to every Chinese takeout place.
One place you didn't think you'd have to pull over so often was Walmart. You were trying to wean yourself off of that. Can you talk about that?
I'm still working on the box store thing. Here's the deal. Again, I'm not trying to live this radical lifestyle where I pretend I'm not connected to a society. I am. And in fact, Native folks, especially when I used to live in Alaska, tell me how there's always was sort of a version of globalization. The Indians in one part, the natives in one part of Alaska might have been good at carving canoes, and the others might be better at rendering fish oil or creating clothes from pelts, so that there was a lot of trade going on. Not everybody knew how to do everything. So you don't have to live in a cave and be totally independent. That said, there's a lot of questions with the bad side of globalization, from bad environmental standards leading to pollution, and it's all one earth. If you pollute one river, you're polluting the whole planet. Pollution in the air goes to everyone. And there's human rights issues with, child workers and what are they paid, blah, blah, blah. So if you want to wean that, one thing you can do is try to stop going to box stores and shop locally. It's a continuing dilemma. I'm on what I call the hypocrisy reduction project. I wouldn't say I'm giving myself an A+, but I'm getting there.
Doug Fine is my guest. His new book is called Farewell My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. After the break, we will talk about how he has been raising goats, including one with a temperament like Judge Judy with PMS. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and NPR correspondent Doug Fine. His new book is called Farewell, My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Doug, I too grew up in Long Island, and I don't recall FFA being a big influence there. But nevertheless, you decided to say, to heck with that, and you were going to raise chickens and goats. How did you go about planning for all this?
Well, I felt like I had to try and produce what I could locally, because something like 60 or 70% of our carbon miles are embedded in our food. Many people might be familiar with the term, but for those who aren't, what we're talking about here is the fact that we kind of have forgotten about things being in season. So we want an apple at certain times of year, it's going to come from New Zealand or Chile or something, and that means that some sort of diesel-powered freighter or truck or plane has to get it here. And so I wanted to try to raise awareness of myself and others about local living, so I thought I'd see how feasible was it for a kid from Long Island who grew up on Domino's pizza and didn't see a real tomato until he was 18 years old. By that I mean just those orange baseballs that are in the supermarket. You know, how much could I make my own food local or at least sort of regional? So therefore, it was time to get goats, chickens, ducks. And the goats I found, of all places, on Craigslist.
You bought your goats online?
Yep. And I had to go pick them up and brought them back to the ranch right before, actually, this tremendous flood started, which is documented in Farewell, My Subaru. But I brought them back to the ranch, and I was tired. It was a long drive. It was a kind of a tense thing with these baby goats back there. I had to bottle feed them and everything. So I put them that first night in the corral that I'd prepared for them and decided I'd earn myself a good night's sleep. And the instant I walked away from the corral, the coyote symphony starts up. It sounded like 500 kids being tickled. And in any language, it was clear what they were saying. They were saying, free takeout buffet on the Funky Butte Ranch. So I had to go out there like some kind of modern Elmer Fudd in my shotgun and camp out that first night with the goats.
You slept with the goats in the goat house?
Yeah, the muddy, dung-filled goat house, yes.
Did it occur to you to bring them in the house?
You know, the funny thing is, whether it occurred to me or not, since they've discovered the pet door, they come in through the pet door themselves. I'll just be sort of in the kitchen cooking or writing or something, and all of a sudden, Melissa and Natalie will be there.
Yeah, you call them, you name them for Melissa Etheridge and Natalie Merchant.
Yeah, I mean, I like both of those singers a lot, but their voices to me sound a little goat-like.
And Melissa has kind of a foul temperament. Are goats hard to love?
No, in fact, they're part of the family, but they are total individuals. Natalie is this princess, and by the way, she's pregnant and due to kid any day now.
Oh, cool.
So I'm calling home and sort of, you know, I'm on the middle of this book tour, I'm calling home and asking how far apart are the contractions. So Natalie's like totally sweet, and her sister Melissa is like the bodyguard. She's kind of like Martina Navratilova, just like just perpetually ready to kick someone's butt.
And so did you just want one of them pregnant at a time, or it just didn't work out for Melissa?
Yeah, no, I just wanted one of them pregnant at a time because it's going to be too much milk otherwise, even with my appetite for ice cream and yogurt.
Was it somewhere you read that two adult nanny goats who were producing milk could provide all the nutrition that an adult needed?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's a little bit of goat propaganda, but it's actually a really fantastic book. About goats by a fellow named Corbett. But, yeah, his take right at the beginning gave me a lot of encouragement because he said, yeah, two goats can provide all the nutrition a human needs except for a few trace vitamins. Now, obviously, I don't want it to be that way. That's why I'm also planting crops and raising chickens. And, you know, let's face it, I'm going to have to buy some of my food, but I'll try what I do buy to buy locally.
And so a coyote got into your chicken coop, and you nicknamed him Dick Cheney, or her.
Yes. Yeah, this was, you have to give credit to this coyote. It was, you know, it was sneaky and didn't issue a lot of reports publicly, which is how it got its name. But, I mean, it was eating locally. There's no carbon miles in its diet, right? It's just out there. But it was incredibly smart. It outsmarted me repeatedly. At one point, I thought I figured out what it was doing to get to my chickens. So I would only leave the chickens out in the afternoons, but then it figured out I would go for an afternoon run with my dogs that were protecting the chickens for an hour, and I'd come back and there'd be one or two more pile of feathers and dead chickens. So this coyote nearly decimated my chicken coop. I'm glad to say, though, my cholesterol levels are almost back up to dangerous levels again now with the new batch we got, because we have a much more secure chicken coop and three dogs patrolling at all times.
What do you pay for the little chicks so that you can raise chickens? Like, how much does one cost that you raise up into a chicken that you'll ultimately eat and get eggs from?
Chickens are really, really inexpensive. They're inexpensive to get for, like, I don't know what it is, $4 or $6. They ship you a dozen chicks live. And then you get the chickens and they grow up, and now that I've got a rooster, it'll be self-sustaining. But they really don't take very much feed. I want to say $20 a month or under. Plus, at the warm times of year, they're out a lot, and so they're foraging and eating maggots and stuff around the ranch, so they're not eating as much grain. Chickens are really the low-maintenance surprise of carbon-neutral living.
Have you dealt with butchering them yet?
No, I'm going to just use them for the eggs, mm-hmm. except in a pinch.
Doug Fine is my guest. His book is called Farewell, My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Doug, I'd like to ask you a couple questions. First of all, you know, we've been talking about green investment here. I'd like to talk about investing in green, looking at corporations that invest in either research and development or corporations that are environmentally friendly. And I was wondering, oh, and also from your experience putting together solar panels, what company, that those types of things. I will take my answer off. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, John. So those are good questions, because I'm realizing more and more, especially as I'm touring, by the way, carbon neutral touring in my vegetable oil truck in support of the book.
So you're not flying?
I am doing a couple flights, but the flights I'm doing carbon offsets for, which is kind of lame, but, you know, better than nothing. So that, what a huge impact corporations can have. For instance, I was doing a reading at a bookstore where the manager told me, it's a chain bookstore, told me that they just recently stopped doing their sort of weekly memos to, you know, 5,000 stores on paper. And I'm thinking, like, this one company with that one decision is probably saving a forest a year, you know. And so really thinking about what your companies do that, you know, and the products that you buy are important in any endeavor. It's the kind of thing like you might ask, is your carrot organic? I think that we can start asking, you know, is the cotton that's going into our T-shirt organic? Is the does the company have green practices? This is the kind of thing we can think about in just about everything that we purchase. Now, specifically when it comes to things like solar peripherals and solar equipment and our renewables, we almost would set those companies to a higher standard. That may or may not be fair. For instance, I happen to live in a part of the country where there are solar panel manufacturers. So I actually can have very few carbon miles on purchasing my next solar panels. Hopefully I won't have to buy any for 30 years, but it's something I'm becoming more aware of now. But I also think that we are in the process of creating a consumer critical mass for our renewable materials. And so if we have enough of a market where millions and millions of people are interested in solar panels, then we can start to be more and more discerning about, okay, which company has the greenest internal practices and which using the best renewable materials, et cetera, recycled steel for the frames or whatever. And for now, I just think it's important that we get the critical mass up there so that there is a market for this. And it's just like today, you can go out and buy a car that, you know, tomorrow there'll be all kinds of options and price points and other options for things like solar panels.
I want to make this point because you are very adamant in the book that you happen to live on the ranch, but not a lot of the things you're doing are not inaccessible or impossible for those of us who live in the city or the suburbs.
I would say 90% of it, down to raising chickens, unless you've got super restrictive zoning, which I recommend lobbying your local government to stop. Chickens are sustainable and low impact. Anybody can have them, even in suburbs. You can get rid of a patch, quarter-acre patch of lawn, start planting local vegetables, have a drip irrigation system so the water's efficient, and don't use pesticides to get into the water table. You can be growing local food. Solar power, granted, it is a large initial investment, but if you can afford it and you get an electric bill today, you can convert to solar power tomorrow. If you want to stop going to the gasoline pump tomorrow, buy a used diesel engine and look up the local mechanic who can do it. Almost every area has somebody who can do the conversion for you. You will pay it back in saved gasoline, the gasoline costs, that is, as well as pollution. And the only thing that I could say that I'm doing now that's probably, you know, tricky as far as location would be raising goats. But even in Silver City, New Mexico, which is a, you know, suburban town, there's a bunch of busy families, people that are working hard, that have a goat co-op going. So they all enjoy the milk every day, but everybody only has to milk themselves once or twice a week.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the time issue and whether or not that's similar to the money in that there's a very big initial capital outlay or initial time outlay, and then it's a little more manageable as it goes along. Or is your chosen lifestyle something that would be tough to do if people had sort of a regular job and three kids and stuff going on?
Yeah, I mean, life is busy, but I think I probably spend, all told, and this is including ranch tasks and things like mending fences and all that, I probably spend about 2 hours a day now, maybe a little bit more if I'm planting or harvesting. So I think it's quite doable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Doug Fine, whose new book is called Farewell, My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. Let's go next to Josh in Dallas. Hi, Josh.
I have a question. Your guest mentioned earlier, Doug mentioned earlier that even green electricity companies are using fossil fuels, and I happen to use a company like that, and I've kind of doubted whether it makes a difference. I just wanted to ask him if he could explain how it doesn't help.
Could you clarify that question? I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch what you're asking.
Well, you said that green electricity companies use fossil fuels still. Can you explain that statement?
Oh, not so much green electricity, but grid electricity companies. Most grid companies, you know, when you pay your utility, you can call them up and find out what they're using. My grid electricity company uses a combination of natural gas, coal, and nuclear. So, no, as far as I'm concerned, none of them are great options.
But you can, and his question spoke to, you know, if your company is ostensibly selling you clean energy and it says it's doing that, there's not necessarily a reason to believe that they're lying to you.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure. And that's true. Some grid companies are doing stuff like if you pay a little bit extra, they will, you know, invest in a wind farm somewhere else. And again, that's a step. It's better than nothing. But I'd rather have our grid system completely go over to solar and wind over time and not be using coal anymore. And boy, that's like talk about foot dragging in a lot of places. That's not happening very quickly.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Let's speak next to William in Richardson. Hi, William.
Hi. I'm curious about the diesel conversion your guest did. I've done two, and I've always had to add heat to the veggie oil in one of the fuel tanks.
Good question, William. So, yeah, there's the issue with vegetable oil is best thought of in the image of clogged arteries. Your fuel lines want nice, hot, liquid vegetable oil flowing through there. If you ever come down after a nice Chinese meal to your kitchen the next morning and it's all white, coagulated, fatty stuff, you don't want that stuff solidifying in your fuel lines. So you have two options. You can either start – this is if you convert to run on straight vegetable oil. You can either convert or have a mechanic convert your vehicle, and then you start your vehicle when it's cold in the morning for about 5 minutes, either on regular diesel. You have two tanks now. You start on regular diesel or biodiesel, and then it converts when the engine reaches a certain temperature. But another option that is a trick I learned from people in Alaska who have to plug their vehicles into heating blocks before they can start it at all is you can do that. You can have a heating block installed around your vegetable oil tank, which then, by electricity, hopefully solar power electricity, heats your your vegetable oil up so that it's ready to start on straight vegetable oil. Hope that answers the question.
How does it work for you, Doug, when you're traveling cross-country on a book tour or whatever else, and you don't necessarily know where the next place is that you can get vegetable oil to run your truck?
Oh, it's a great way to meet new people. So here's the deal. I have an 80-gallon vegetable oil tank that's been installed. You have a second tank installed when you do this conversion. And it's in my case, it's in the truck bed, but it can be anywhere, even in, let's say, a small like Volkswagen diesel. So I have an 80-gallon vegetable oil tank, and I get about 20 miles per gallon on the highway in the ridiculously oversized American truck that I bought. And so that gets me 1,600 miles per tank, and that's just highway miles. It usually doesn't turn out to be that good, but even call it 1,300 miles. So that's practically halfway across the U.S., but when I need to do a fill-up, I could bring my portable filter and dumpster dive, But there's actually a neat website called fillupforfree.org, the four is the number four, and it just has people all over the country who are processing and filtering veggie oil. Some give it away, some sell it, but it's just kind of fun making contact with folks saying, hey, I'm on a book tour, I'm passing through Boulder on this day, you got any vegetable oil?
Do you ever wonder what people think of you, and assuming that you're driving this giant gas guzzler as you're riding around, do you want a bumper sticker that says, don't worry, I'm running this on vegetable oil?
Only recently did I get the sticker of this fabulous guy who did the conversion for me. His company's named Pop Diesel, and I recently put a fender magnet on at his request. But prior to that, it works great blending in with the right-wing ranchers and cowhands and stuff like that because, I'm driving the F-250 and I've got the cowboy hat, and all I need to do is spit tobacco juice, and folks assume I'm on this, I'm afraid of UN helicopters coming in. But the truth is, all kidding aside, green now is not a political thing. I wouldn't even consider myself necessarily so far left-wing. It's just everybody realizes that it's patriotic, actually, to be using less foreign oil. And actually, the future of our economy is dependent upon us being more energy independent. And so it's not even a political issue anymore, although some of the local ranchers get the clue in that there's something weird going on when they smell my exhaust and suddenly have a craving for Chinese food.
Do you have to retrofit your home in any way when your Long Island relatives come to visit?
I lived in Alaska for a couple of years, so compared to when I lived in an Alaskan cabin, they're just thankful that there's a light switch they can flick on. So, no, actually, all kidding aside, solar power is so seamless. I do not even notice that I am on solar power. The fridge is going, the washing machine, the stereo. I honestly do not notice that I'm on solar power, except when other people have a power failure.
Doug Fine is my guest. He's an NPR correspondent and author of several books, including the most recent Farewell, My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is author and NPR correspondent Doug Fine. His new book is called Farewell, My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Bonnie in Duncanville. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. This is kind of funny. I'm actually sitting in a wholesale club parking lot getting ready to lay out a real big carbon footprint here, but I'm really excited about this book. I'm gonna Google it or maybe stop and get it if it's out. And I came from California to Texas 2 years ago, and in California we had some property, and I had my own chickens. I had a dozen or so little girls, and I took really good care of them. I loved them. I couldn't eat them either. I did raise some meat hens and took them to my local Asian chicken butchering, I don't know what you call them, but they were a poultry butchering only for specialty Asian birds. And at the time, they would take small flocks and process them for you. I just dropped them off and got them back in a nice little vacuum-sealed bag. When his nephew, who was a little bit more ambitious, took over, they upped the minimum to 200 birds. So I stopped processing my own meat. But my hens were incredibly rewarding. They gave me at least an egg a day for each one of them, and I got some of the kinds that lay the blue eggs and the green eggs, the Araucanas, and my kids had a blast with them, and I'm about ready to pay $2 a dozen for eggs in the store, and I think that I'm really discouraged because now I'm in a suburb I'm in a county suburb in Texas where that kind of makes it a little unique. The county regulates us for the most part, but the HOA seems to have a certain amount of authority, and I'm just wanting to get some suggestions from you about how to approach my HOA about raising a nice, clean flock of chickens, basically spoiled little birds they were, in a backyard sitting.
Interesting question. Any ideas, Doug?
Yeah, wow, what a great story that is, by the way, and it's so encouraging to hear people that are interested in doing this. Chickens really, they are. They're fun. They're low maintenance. It's nice to have chickens around. Yeah, gosh. I don't know. I would say, and by the way, you said $2 a dozen. Maybe you're talking $3, $4, $5 for organic in a co-op type situation. And the zoning is so tricky. I would just say a personal approach. I had a similar situation where the county assessor had to come by and declare that I really was rural to change my sort of property tax status, and it was no problem because my two rambunctious goats we've been discussing were out, and they jumped right on them and kind of crapped on them, and he said, oh, yeah, I guess you're local. But as far as, you know, getting the zoning approval, it's so frustrating. The only other thing that comes to mind would be if there are other like-minded folks in your area, is to get some sort of petition together, maybe a note from a vet saying that it's perfectly good and healthy and that this, you know, the setup that you have is going to be, run well. But it's just silly that there would be zoning preventing people from growing their own food. I'm a big believer that we're a stronger America with a more secure food supply, and that to me entails local people providing their own food. I mean, we were once 95% farmers in this country. Now we're 1%. And by the way, thanks for mentioning the book. It is available and should be at bookstores everywhere and online bookstores and all that stuff. But also signed copies on my blog at dougfine.com.
They don't sell it at, like, Costco and Walmart, do they?
I don't know about that. If they do, they didn't read it carefully.
I have to wonder if part of the zoning issue is just the fact that so many of us are, you know, raised in the city or the suburbs and are just entirely disconnected from our food supply to the extent that it seems sort of dirty or scary to do any of this at home.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of a fear factor going on. Even with organic standards, there's a lot of complaints going on from small farmers that the USDA rules for organic and stuff are difficult for small farmers to comply with because they're geared towards the type of sanitary conditions that a giant factory farm needs, not towards what a small farm needs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Doug Fine, whose book is called Farewell My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. Let's go next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Great job, Doug. I'm sure I'm going to enjoy the book. I've got a little bit a different question for you. I raise and train Belgian Malinois, and I'm wondering what kind of dogs you used for guarding your chickens and how you trained them.
Fantastic question. Yeah, a lot of dogs themselves might be inclined to look at chickens as a free takeout buffet. And I have had a recommendation to get these breeds that are known as guardian dogs, one of which you've just described, and there's a number of them. And I haven't, for one main reason. I now have three dogs. Two of them are kind of herding-type dogs, cattle-type dogs, and the third one is kind of a golden retriever. And while none of them are by nature herding dogs, the three of them together consider themselves to be a pack that protect the ranch. And so you believe it. They know when there's coyotes, and I know because at 3 a.m. they go nuts when the coyotes are coming around. So combined, they do a good enough job in terms of protecting the ranch from coyotes. But there are specific breeds. If you go to any sort of kennel club chart, there are specific guardian breeds that you might want to get. As far as training them, I use a very, very simple technique as far as not harming the chickens. The goats, by the way, we've already talked about Melissa, the Martina Navratilova goat. She can take, I think, any mountain lion or coyote, but certainly the dogs are scared of her. So no worries in terms of that. But with regard to watching the chickens, in particular, one of my dogs, Sadie, had a sort of natural appetite for chickens when I first brought her to the ranch. And so now she's trained, but what I did was very, very simple anti-Pavlovian training. You just watch her, and the second she even looks at a chicken, I pounce on her and put the fear of God in her. And it's like anything else with dogs. You do it consistently over time, and now she knows she has one job with regard to chickens, which is watch out for coyotes and bark and keep them away.
Do you worry about the dogs and the goats? You write about an incident with a rattlesnake that was really scary. Do you worry that your animals are going to, you know, step in the wrong spot?
You mean because of predators?
Yeah. Well, do you worry the dogs are going to get bit by a snake?
Oh, gosh, right. Well, for sure. In fact, I actually have a hiking buddy who claims, I mean, he's just trying to be kind of a tough guy cowboy, but he claims that the reason he has a Jack Russell Terrier is for hikes so that it would get bit before he would. But I am actually thinking about bringing some rattlesnake, treatment, some anti-venom, into a freezer on the ranch for that very purpose.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Alex in Garland. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. I had a question about solar panels, and living in Irving, basically the case is it occasionally hails. And I'm wondering if there are hardened solar panels or that would resist hail, or if this is something I even need to worry about.
That's a good question. I was worried about that, too. We, too, have had some pretty serious hailstorms to the point that, and in fact, it's a fairly significant part of one of the chapters in Farewell My Subaru, was finally getting my drip system installed, planting my seeds, and then, boom, biblical hail comes. It's like, what next? But I was worried about that, too. And this was hail so severe that people's vehicles to this day are pockmarked. I was lucky enough to be in town on the day when the hail hit the valley. But no damage to the solar panels. I've been told, freak events can happen, but that generally speaking, you don't have to worry about it. The silicon and the glass will hold up, especially since you're going to have them at an angle, and so you're not going to have direct strikes. But it's the kind of thing where if you're going to install them with a professional, that's a good question to ask about, are there screens or other ways of protecting yourself?
Was it easy to have that added to your homeowner's policy?
Good question. I don't know that my homeowner's policy knows that I have solar panels.
You might want to check into it first, I guess, before you find out how much it's going to cost you. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Aaron in Arlington. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. I'm enjoying the show. I just wanted to say I have four chickens, and I live in Arlington. We had a pygmy goat, but we don't have one anymore. But I had a predator that was attacking my chickens, and I thought it was a neighboring animal, a cat or a dog. Come to find out, it was a possum.
Wow.
And he was getting in my hen house and eating my chickens. But the chickens roam free in my backyard, and if I can encourage anybody to have a pet, that is the pet to have. My kids love them. Everybody loves them. I get eggs, and I just wanted to share that with y'all. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. I did not know that a possum would take down a chicken.
No, but, this is a bigger issue of if we want to live in an earth that is alive, if we want to restore ecosystems that had been damaged in the past, or if we want to live in a place that is still an alive ecosystem, we need to have this. The realtors don't tell you. You need to have this awareness of the fact that living ecosystem means predator-prey balance. The predators have a right to be there, and in fact, we want them to be there because it means that the ecosystem is healthy. And so, and they're the first thing to go, generally. The wolves and the mountain lions are the first things that disappear. We should just take basic precautions, both for our own safety, our kids' safety, and our livestock safety. But I think we should be glad to have them. And it's our job to protect our livestock from the predators rather than getting rid of the predators.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Doug Fine is my guest. The new book is called Farewell, My Subaru. Let's go next to Louisa in Bailey. Hi, Louisa.
Hi there. I have a comment on the dogs. I live in Bailey. I started a farm about 4 years ago, and we all use Great Pyrenees.
Yeah.
As they're great with the goats. You don't keep them as a pet. They have to stay with the goats. And they're doing a great job with the coyotes. I haven't had one. And I have a question also. I raised boar goats, and, I didn't know you had to trim their feet all the time.
Yeah.
And 20 goats take me 4 days. Is it the same for milk goats?
It is. I mean, a lot depends on the terrain and how much they can get out. I kind of like hoof trimming. It's no big deal. And I, of course, only have 2 goats, which is about to change any day now to 3 or 4 with Natalie Kidding. So I could see how that would be a hassle because it takes, 15 or 20 minutes just to do the 2 once a month. But, yeah, you do have to hoof trim them.
And you have a veterinarian, but you've also learned to provide a lot of medical care yourself.
Oh, yeah, no, the goats have never seen a vet. I do everything. So, yeah, you definitely become Dr. Doolittle out there. There's no other way around it.
Was that hard for you to learn how to give injections and all that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get, you know, faint when I deal with, you know, some sort of giving blood now. So, yeah, definitely it was tricky. Plus, you don't like to see your animals sick. There's one scene in Farewell, My Subaru where Natalie, when she was young, almost died. And you get attached to these animals. They become part of the family.
Are the other farmers around you and ranchers, are they? Do they kind of scoff when they find out that you have named your goats and that you care about them?
No, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say so. I think everybody probably cares for their animals to a degree. But we'll see what the reaction is locally once people start reading this book.
Is there anything else that you want to do to convert the ranch? Or is it done?
Oh, yeah, quite a lot. So in the next couple of years, there's a few big additions I want to do. One is I want to start getting more involved in rain catchment, which anybody can do. It's basically a glorified way of saying put gutters on and have them fall off into a cistern or a barrel. And then from there, you know, then I'm just using less groundwater, whether I want to irrigate with it or whatever. Another thing is I've got an addiction to tropical fruits. I really like my bananas and my oranges and my limes. And so I want to get a sustainable greenhouse going where I can grow that stuff, which we can do here in New Mexico, Texas, and places like that, so that I'm not, you know, importing bananas from Ecuador anymore.
And is that something that you will build from a kit? How does that work?
A greenhouse?
Yeah.
There's a lot of different ways to do it. There's greenhouse books out there, and you can order them pre-made, but then you're getting plastic, which is, you know, petroleum somewhere. I'd rather do it from, like, recycled glass or something like that.
The other thing that's fun about the book is that you go through it and you go through a bunch of relationships as the book moves on. And then finally you meet this great woman who seems just entirely game with your lifestyle, which is not exactly what most people might be used to.
Maybe so. Yeah, it's true. Because New Mexico is such a world capital for a lot of kind of new agey, crystal-y kind of ideas, I, in my own head and in the book, I try not to immediately draw the connection between the fact that as soon as I start really living local and thinking about the food I put into my body and getting petroleum out of my life, that then all of a sudden I'm at the happiest I've ever been in a great relationship. But that, in fact, is how it has turned out in real life.
That's great. And is there anything that you've changed that you have to admit was easier when you were on the grid and living fat and happy?
Hamburgers.
Uh-huh.
I used to be able to just pull up to a restaurant and buy a hamburger. Now I have to think local buffalo meat, organically raised, whatever.
So you don't do, like, chain food ever?
I don't know about it. I never say never. I don't want to be too extreme. It was funny. I was at a book tour stop recently in Santa Fe and went in and got a crepe. And I'm like, wait a second. If I'm eating fresh raspberries in late March, early April in New Mexico, these raspberries are coming from far away. So nobody's perfect. And really, I just don't want people to feel guilty. The reality is if everybody reduced their carbon footprint 5%, did, let's say, one thing, converted their car to vegetable oil or their house to solar, that's 30, 40, 50, 60% right there. And so those are huge changes if everybody in the Western world made those changes.
Doug Fine's new book is called Farewell, My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living. You can find him online at dougfine.com. Doug, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.